Hello, I'm Tom Sito, and this is number 0449, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0449. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Cheryl Costa, author of UFO Sightings Desk Reference.
We added up all the numbers for the two major reporting databases, National UFO Reporting Center and the MUFON, Mutual UFO Network. We put all the numbers together for all 50 states and the District of Columbia, and we crunched them. We did it for a period from 2001 to 2015. We added county data to the listings so we could literally break it down to the county. Nobody had ever done that kind of thing before. Nobody knew where the real clusters were. Everybody thought, well, I think they're out there or they're over there. And most of the time, UFOs were not where everybody thought they were.
Actress Marion Ross, best known as Mrs. C on Happy Days, she's written her memoir entitled My Days, Happy and Otherwise.
Normally, I wouldn't have wanted to write a book, but it's interesting to look back and see that I followed my dream. I did what I set out to do. But you know, I had a Canadian mother from Saskatchewan, and I was raised on you can be anything. That's the kind of way I was raised, and occasionally I'll meet people who weren't raised that way, and I think, you weren't told that you could be anything?
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0449 was Tom Sito, an animator, he used to work for Disney, and also a professor of animation at the University of Southern California. He's also the author of several books on animation history, including Moving Innovation, A History of Computer Animation. So, the minds of future animators are in the right hands with Professor Tom Sito. There you go. Thank you very much, Tom, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is supported by listeners and is fan-funded radio and depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Contrary to all the hype that Christmas gets, this is the time of year that is the holiest on the Christian calendar, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And if Jesus, or someone claiming to be Jesus, is coming back, you can be sure that he must have built up an appetite. Richard Lee Quintero claims he's Jesus Christ, and he allegedly broke into a North Carolina Pizza Hut because he was starving to death. Even the most heavenly people get the munchies sometimes. On Wednesday, the Greensboro, North Carolina man claiming to be Jesus Christ called 911 and told the operator that he had broken into a Pizza Hut because, as I said earlier, he was starving to death. But don't take my word for it. Here's the 911 call in all its yummy goodness.
911, what is your emergency?
Yes, this is Jesus Christ, and I just broke into the Pizza Hut. I broke the window in, and I'm here. Jesus is here now. He's back to Earth.
All right, and so you don't work there?
No, I just broke in, had a pizza. I'm Jesus.
And what was your name again?
My name is Jesus.
What's your last name, Jesus?
Christ.
Okay, and what do you look like?
I look like Jesus. What else do I supposed to look like?
Why'd you do that?
Because I'm Jesus. I can do whatever I want. We're tired of Judases on this earth. We're going to clean this earth up. So what are you up to?
Man, where do you live at?
I don't. I'm from heaven.
How'd you get over to the Pizza Hut?
I'm from heaven, sir.
Okay. And did you break a front window?
Yeah, I broke the door window, sir.
And you eat a pizza?
Yeah. Had a Mountain Dew.
You going to stay there for a minute?
Yeah.
You ain't got any weapons or anything on you, do you?
No, I'm not violent, sir.
Okay. Just hungry?
Yeah, I'm starving to death.
All right.
Everybody's been treating me mean. I've been beat up in this town. I'm from Indiana.
You're from Indiana?
Yes.
Okay.
People keep beating me up.
Where have you been staying at?
Everywhere I keep getting kicked out of places. I got schizophrenia, sir.
Yeah, nobody else is there with you.
Cops say Jesus broke into the High Point, North Carolina Pizza Hut location at 4:30 a.m. through a smashed window. They arrested him at about 15 minutes after he broke in. He's charged with felony break and enter and felony larceny, and he's currently behind bars at High Point Jail with bail set at $1,000. And at press time, he hasn't performed any miracles, hasn't walked on water, and hasn't turned water into wine. Also, no one has bailed him out, and Judas isn't available for comment. Still, with fast food and religious-sounding names, police say a 37-year-old man was far from loving it when workers at a McDonald's restaurant in Oregon refused to make him 30 double cheeseburgers, and he then tried to destroy the Golden Arches. Police arrested Jedediah Ezekiel Fulton on March 16th on suspicion of second-degree disorderly conduct, second-degree criminal trespass, second-degree criminal mischief, and harassment. Authorities say Fulton became upset when the fast food restaurant in the western Oregon town of Sutherland declined to make his order. Police say he destroyed a banner and then attacked the arches. The Sutherland Police Department says he also grabbed a person's shirt and that a witness who was afraid for that person's life pulled a gun. Wow. Ezekiel didn't see the wheel, didn't see the light, didn't get the burgers. Yeah. 25-year-old Thomas Hartman filed a police report in Omaha, Nebraska, claiming his brother had robbed him. The next day, police brought Thomas in for questioning. "You just need to come clean," a detective told him, "because I have visuals of your brother from that time of this robbery, and he's on the other side of town." While he was being questioned, Hartman's 17-year-old girlfriend was in the next room, and according to police, she was explaining how she was giving out sexual favors for money under Hartman's direction. Later, officers caught Hartman standing on a chair to reach the ceiling, and they found a wallet and a small bag of cocaine hidden in the ceiling tile. Hartman was charged with false reporting, drug possession, and other crimes. You know, when you're accusing someone else of a non-existent crime, it's best you really, really, really get your story straight, especially if you're also pimping out your girlfriend. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, 23-year-old Jacoby Schmidt and 22-year-old Ashley Corelli, both of Ohio, were charged with public indecency and disorderly conduct after the couple were arrested for having sex in full view of children. The sheriff's office received a call about two people having sex in front of kids at the Walker Elementary School. Officers located the couple behind the school next to the playground where 11 children were playing and several adults were supervising them. The two continued having sex even when the deputies approached them. Corelli, who was totally naked and wrapped in a blanket, reportedly exposed her breasts. Schmidt was naked from the waist down. Schmidt and Corelli told authorities they did not know that it was illegal to have sex at that spot. They also said they didn't realize that there were people watching from a nearby playground. Authorities found several cans of Bud Light beer in the grass close to where the couple was having sex. They were taken into custody, both the couple and the beer. Seriously, is there anybody who doesn't know that you can't legally have sex in public areas? Also, they didn't know people were around? Come on! When have you been anywhere near where children are playing and found them to be completely silent? If kids are playing, you know about it, no matter how engaged you are, unless you're having sex and are also wearing noise-canceling headphones. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Cheryl Costa is an expert on UFO sighting statistics. She was recently named Researcher of the Year by the International UFO Congress. Her work has culminated in the creation of the compendium UFO Sightings Desk Reference. Cheryl joins us on the line right now from Syracuse, New York. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, how you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. First of all, as I said in the introduction, you're considered an expert in UFO sighting statistics. What exactly does that mean, and how does one become an expert in UFO sighting statistics?
Well, I wrote the only book that's ever been done on the topic matter. We added up all the numbers for the two major reporting databases, National UFO Reporting Center and the MUFON, Mutual UFO Network. And we put all the numbers together for all 50 states and the District of Columbia. And we crunched them. We did it for a period from 2001 to 2015. And we added county data to the listings so we could literally break it down to the county. And nobody had ever done that kind of thing before. Nobody knew where the real clusters were. Everybody thought, well, I think they're out there or they're over there. And most of the time, the UFOs were not where everybody thought they were.
How did your interest in this begin in the first place?
Well, okay, I had my first sighting when I was about 12, back in 1965 with my parents. I had another significant sighting when I was in Vietnam in 1971, Christmas Eve of 1971, I had one. And those two events sort of changed me, but I didn't get involved with doing anything about it. And then I retired from my aerospace security job with Lockheed Martin back in 2011, 32 years with Lockheed. And so what happened was I was working for a newspaper, and I saw an article one night online, and it said UFOs have been declining since the 80s. Maybe they were always just an urban legend. And my first gut instinct was that's misinformation, and that got me going. And I added some numbers up and realized that what they were saying was bogus. And a couple of months later, I was writing an article for a different newspaper in town. I was writing a weekly column, and I've been doing it for 5 years here in July, coming July.
Okay, so when people talk UFOs, they often think of extraterrestrials. However, if you were to talk about a UFO as to what that acronym is, it's unidentified flying objects. So,
yes.
In your estimation, what is a UFO to you?
Okay, first thing. Give an example. From 2001 to 2015, the United States had 121,000 sightings reported. And we think only about 1 in 50 people report what they see. So that's a lot. And a UFO, unidentified flying object, it's just that. You don't know what it is, and it looks weird to you, and you report it, it's a UFO. Now, somebody comes along and and analyzes it later and realizes it was just an airplane on the landing pattern for the local airport, well, then that's an IFO. It's been identified. And most of the serious investigators, MUFON investigators especially, the number varies a little bit, but the consideration is somewhere between 4 and 20% of that 120,000 are something completely unexplained.
Okay, so the two sightings that you say you personally witnessed, one as a child and one when you were in Vietnam, I believe you said. What do you think those were?
They weren't from this world. What I saw was, in both cases, the thing was parked out there for a little bit. And when I was 12, it was parked out there for 20 minutes in the clear blue sky, big round silver ball. And when it decided to go, it was like you see in Star Trek or something like this. And this is long before Star Trek. This thing just went, poof, gone. Okay. The one I saw in Vietnam, a friend of mine and I were walking down to the chapel for midnight mass, and we saw this thing streaking across this beautiful starlit sky, and then we're both thinking it's a jet, and then it stopped and it started dancing around like a fairy, and then poof, it took off. And to me, those were something very genuine in terms of a UFO, probably not of Earth technology. But when people ask me what are they, I tell them, hey, it might be a government high-tech thing, it might be people from another world, it might be individuals from another dimension, and that one there is a hot topic these days, and I really tend to think it's along that line. And it could be some other kind of commercial aircraft or something we don't know about, and what somebody misidentified. It can be a number of things.
So your compendium, UFO Sightings Desk Reference, who is prone or apt to use it, and what would they use it for? What would they gather from going through your desk reference?
Well, we wrote it as a desk reference, and that's why it's called reference. There's no sighting write-ups in there. It is also, we've condensed the numbers down to charts, graphs, and tables. And it looks like something the Census Department may have put out. Okay, we crunch it like that. And if somebody is in the least bit interested in researching UFO sighting clusters in their own state, or maybe nationally or whatever, this book's just what they want. I'll give an example. Say an investigator's getting ready to go out there and check out a sighting report, and it's in a particular town, in a particular county. If it was MUFON, he'd only have about 30% of the data in their CMS system, and he'd have to spend a couple of hours looking it up. So with our book, we've got both National UFO Reporting Center and MUFON, and he can get a very clear picture because we added county data to the to all the cities. We got a table for that, and we added it in. So now somebody can actually look up a state, look up a county, and literally, probably if they can reach out to me, I can drill right down to the municipal level for them.
So to give an analogy, it's just the data. It's just the statistics. It's as if someone was a big fan of baseball and they wanted just the baseball stats, but not without the narrative that goes with it.
Exactly. There's no anecdotal information. We did put five chapters of analysis in the beginning of the book, but overall, the book has all the charm of a bank ledger. But anybody who's into any kind of armchair investigations or research to UFOs, it's a wonderful snapshot picture of the first 15 years of the 21st century. Now, you're in Montreal, right?
Yes.
Okay, now, the totals for Canada, and this is only National UFO Reporting Center data. We're still working on it international here. Between 2001 and 2017, Canada had 4,755, and in Quebec province, you had 347 UFO sightings reported, and that's about 7% for the country.
And is that, in your estimation, a high number, a low number, or an average number? No,
well, that's a pretty high number. You rank in number four. Quebec province ranks in number four in the country. Ontario is number one at about 43% of the sightings. British Columbia is number two at 21%. Alberta is about 10%, and then Quebec, and then it goes down from there.
Now, does this have a finite end, or is this something that you regularly update?
Okay, the book that's out there right now, we stopped in 2015. We are probably going to push an update, but the update, it's complicated with the publisher. If we change more than 10% of the book, then we have to actually publish a new book. So what we're thinking of doing is publishing a new book that, about a year from now. The one thing we're working on right now is the cities directory, because when we made the original book, we only went down to the county level. People don't spell the names of their cities very well, and we couldn't put the cities in there. So it also would have made the book about a 5-pound book, and it would have been about 700 pages. What we're going to do is publish a cities directory where you can literally look up a state, look up a county, and go right down to the municipal level for sightings. And we're hoping to put that out within the year.
How does one get their hands on the book?
The book, if you go to Amazon.com and look up UFO Sightings Desk Reference, you'll find it. In fact, we publish through them so they can get it to you in 2 to 4 days, depending upon what time of day you order it.
And how much does it sell for?
$29.95. We used to sell it for $39 because it was intended to be a reference book for libraries, but we brought the price down when we realized there was a lot of people who really wanted to have it for research purposes.
And do you get a chance to do a lot of, because you write the blog, as you mentioned, do you get a chance to do a lot of speaking engagements and talking to people about this?
Well, I just won. Lately, I've been doing an awful lot of presentations here regionally with like local libraries. I did a senior center yesterday. The place was packed. And so I've been doing a lot of speaking at what I call lower level. I just came back from 2 weeks ago at the International UFO Congress in Tempe, Arizona, or Scottsdale, Arizona. I was awarded the Researcher of the Year, which completely surprised me. And So that's the only national conference I've been invited to, but I'm starting to get booked up for next year for other conferences.
Interesting topic indeed. Cheryl, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Anytime you want me, just give me a call.
Cheryl Costa, who has compiled the compendium UFO Sightings Desk Reference. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the page for this show, which is show number 0449, and you'll find links to her blog. Plus, you'll also find links to Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Here's a penny for your thoughts from the Stuff File program coming to you from Montreal, Canada, a country that doesn't have pennies.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the delightfully engaging Marion Ross. You remember her from Happy Days. She has her memoirs out entitled My Days, Happy and Otherwise. Also, we do indeed have an Idiot of the Day coming your way and lots more Stuff File news here on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, customs officials at a New York airport said an airline crew member on a flight from Jamaica was found to be hiding 9 pounds of cocaine inside his pants. U.S. Customs and Border Protection said Jamaican citizen Hugh Hall was a crew member on a Fly Jamaica Airways flight that arrived at JFK from Montego Bay. Hugh presented himself for inspection upon arrival in New York and was taken to a private search room where officers found 4 packages of cocaine taped to his legs under his pants. The cocaine weighed about 9 pounds and had an estimated street value of $160,000. This seizure is another example of our CBP officers being ever vigilant in protecting the United States from the distribution of illicit drugs, said Leon Hayward, who is the acting director of CBP's New York field operations. Now, I'm just curious, aren't you kind of curious to know what tipped off authorities and why they were looking at Hall's pants in the first place? Anything to declare, folks? Yeah. An Alabama sheriff legally used more than $750,000 of funds meant to feed inmates to purchase a beach house. Etowah County Sheriff Todd Entrekin said he follows the state law passed before World War II that allows sheriffs to keep excess inmate feeding funds for themselves. Entrekin reported on state ethics forms that he made more than $250,000 each of the past 3 years through the funds. The sheriff's annual salary is more than $93,000. He and his wife purchased a 4-bedroom house with an in-ground pool and canal access in September for $740,000. Entrekin got a $592,000 mortgage. The home is one of several properties with a total assessed value of more than $1.7 million that the couple own together or separately. Wow. Now I have to find out what they're feeding the inmates. I mean, do they go from caviar and foie gras directly to the bread and water route? Yikes. Anyway, according to police in Michigan, a man who was desperate for some cigarettes in the middle of the night used a stolen snowmobile to crash through the glass windows of a store. The Bay County Sheriff's Office arrested 38-year-old Michael P. Stark after being accused of breaking into the store and stealing cigarettes and lottery tickets. Stark was charged with breaking and entering with intent to commit a larceny, unlawfully stealing a motor vehicle, and larceny in a building. In addition to the robbery-related charges, Stark is facing 1 count of assaulting, obstructing, or resisting police. According to the police investigation, Stark found a snowmobile and used it to break the glass doors at Dore's party store. He then entered the store through the broken glass and took cigarettes and lottery tickets. Stark then fled the scene with the stolen snowmobile. Police officers who responded to the scene followed the snowmobile tracks and found Stark. Security surveillance at the store recorded the moment Stark crashed through the doors with the snowmobile. If convicted, Stark faces up to 10 years in prison. Boy, life is tough when you really, really, really want a cigarette. Also, did Stark not realize that snowmobiles leave tracks? Oh, and wouldn't it be ironic if we later find out that among the lottery tickets he stole was a winner? That would complete his unlucky trifecta, wouldn't it? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, on March 12th in Northumberland, England, a car thief making a getaway in a Mini Cooper S discovered the small car wasn't quite small enough to navigate a narrow stone staircase in Carlisle Park. Northumbria police were called to the park at around 11:30 p.m., where they found the car and its unnamed 31-year-old driver both wedged tightly between the staircase walls. Area residents speculated that the driver might have been trying to reenact a scene from the 1969 movie The Italian Job. Said Chris Stoker, "I'm sure the older Minis would have gone down no problem." Yeah. This is another classic case of someone who never pays attention to the axiom of, "Don't try this at home." Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? For 11 years, Marion Ross was the head of one of TV's favorite households on Happy Days. Now she has written her story in her new memoir, which delves into her on- and off-screen struggles. It's entitled My Days, Happy and Otherwise. Marion joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Marion.
Good morning, or the afternoon, good day. Yes, very nice to talk to you.
Very nice to talk to you as well. Now, as I said, you were, you know, the head of a household on Happy Days for basically 11 years, but I don't want to give anybody the impression that that's the beginning and end of your career. You had a career way before Happy Days, and you had a great career after Happy Days as well. Do you find that sometimes we focus too much on the role you played as Mrs. C?
Do you know something? I'm so smart. I don't care one bit. Isn't that nice? Because it's what we all need is a handle. And if you look at any great big star, it's usually one of the credits that the whole career kind of rests on. So I think that's just, I'm lucky to have such a good handle, right?
Yeah. Since you played such an iconic role and it was a mother figure, do you find that people really do think you're Mrs. C? And by that I mean, are people surprised when they meet you that you're not Mrs. C?
No, because I look very much like that, and I try to act like that, you know. I'm a compulsive, nice person, you know. So.
Your book, as I mentioned, is entitled My Days, Happy and Otherwise. I want to talk a little bit about the subtitle of that book, Happy and Otherwise. You talk about some of the things in your book that weren't the happiest of moments. Was it cathartic for you to write this book?
Well, I wasn't very keen on doing it, you know, but my son, Jim Meskimen, got after me, and once I got started talking to David Laurel, who was actually doing the writing, I was doing the talking, it became a fun and nice thing to do. But normally, I wouldn't have wanted to write a book, you know. It's interesting to look back and see that I followed my dream. I did what I set out to do. But, you know, I had a Canadian mother from Saskatchewan, and I was raised on you can be anything. That's the kind of the way I was raised, and occasionally I'll meet people who weren't raised that way, and I think, you weren't told that you could be anything?
Now, when the role of Marion Cunningham came along on Happy Days, and first of all, for those who aren't aware, that wasn't even on Happy Days first time, because it was an episode of Love American Style, right?
Right. It was called Love and the Happy Days, I think it was called.
Yeah.
Yes, and we didn't have, we were not able to get Tom Bosley, so we had a different actor as the father and a different little daughter. So it's gone through a metamorphosis.
So when you get the role and it's then turned into a television series, I mean, you had been acting for a while. This is not your first merry-go-round, as it were. But here you are on a huge hit. How did that change things for you?
First of all, we didn't know it was going to be a huge hit. And you know, I was under contract to Paramount Studios when I was 22. That's my first professional outing, but I've been wanting to be an actress since I was about 13 years old, living in Minnesota. So the fact that Happy Days became an iconic hit because of the Fonz, you know, and that took about the first 5 years. And then it was after that that we realized that we had a hit on our hands.
What is it that you would want to tell people about working on that show that you think would surprise them?
Well, they probably don't know what a wonderful softball team we had. And the softball team was very important to keeping us together, because Gary Marshall... It was his idea to always keep everybody playing ball. And these are young boys. All these kids were like 18, 19 years old, and they were all good athletes and good ball players to begin with. So that was a natural thing to have happen.
And you did Happy Days in front of a live audience, did you not?
Yes, we started on one camera, and then moved up to three camera show, which with an audience out there.
I'm guessing, because I do believe stage is your first love, I'm guessing that made it much better for you as an actress to have the response of a live audience.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Then you weren't, as we rehearsed all week, you weren't just tied to that specific script. They could see, the writers could be watching all week long, and they could see all your various colors, and they started adapting their writing for what they could see that you could do. It's like they would say to me, Marion, when we do the table read on Monday, read all those girls and read those older women parts, and read all those feminine parts, you know, the extra parts. So I would just knuckle down and really, you know, read the bejesus out of those parts, and then the writers' heads would snap around, look at me, and they begin to write more and more stuff for me.
So how much of Marion Cunningham is Marion Ross, or vice versa?
I think there's probably a lot in there, and that's, in fact, if you're going to do a series, you better do something that is very comfortable and close to you, because you're going to do it every day. And if you go on for 11 seasons, you don't want to be playing a role that's not comfortable. We were all kind of playing ourselves, you know.
I know you've, as I said, you've had a very diverse career, both before and after Happy Days, but was there any difficulty after you finished playing the role of Mrs. Cunningham to find something that was different or challenging to you, because you had played that role for so many years and people saw you in that role?
Yeah. Right. You feel compelled to prove that you're an actor. So what I did was I went to the Globe Theater in San Diego, went back to the stage as fast as I could get an opportunity to go back to the stage, and... It's always, you don't want to get locked into anything. And then I had the good fortune of being in a series that was very short run, 30, I think we made 36 shows, and it was called Brooklyn Bridge for Gary Goldberg.
Right.
And I played a Jewish Polish grandmother. So that was a real stretch. I was amazed that I was finally able to nail that part. And because I am really a character actress, I'm an actress, you know?
Now, you mentioned character actress. Is that something you've known you were all along? Because sometimes people evolve into character actors. Some people begin as character actors, and some people kind of step away or try to step away from being a character actor because they want to be the ingenue and the star. So was something...
Yes, you can get kind of locked out of some of those good roles, and that's a shame. No, because I was such a serious actress. If you read my book, you're going to see, when I was in Minnesota, I would go to the library and read Who's Who of Famous People and read the lives of actors. And I only wanted to go to the stage, to go to Broadway and become a stage actor. So, like a real actor. And a real actor is where you totally lose yourself inside somebody else. You know, I wasn't keen on being me. I wasn't a raving beauty. I love being somebody else.
Well, you just said you weren't a raving beauty. So do you find as a character actress that as life gets actually better for you as a character actress as you age?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No, I'm not very interested in what I look like. I want to see if I can be somebody else. In fact, when I was very young, like in the third grade, there was a girl in the class, and she had the most interesting way of talking. I just loved the way she talked and was so cute. Oh, I love that. So I started to talk the same way. And we both got sent to a remedial speech class, and I stamped right out of it. And she's there to this day, I guess.
It's a pleasure talking to you, Marion. And I've got a few more questions I want to ask you, but we need to take a quick break, so we'll do that right now, and we'll come back. We're talking with Marion Ross, who you all remember from the television show Happy Days. She has written her memoirs, which is entitled My Days, Happy and Otherwise. And we'll continue our conversation here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Stick around. There's more Stuff File coming your way in a moment.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Nearly one out of every four households includes someone who suffers from migraine headaches. Migraines can be debilitating. But fortunately, doctors have discovered that some medicines approved for ailments like high blood pressure can be very effective for treating migraines, too. This so-called off-label use of these medicines is perfectly legal. However, drug makers are banned from promoting their prescription drugs for uses other than those specifically approved by the FDA. As a result, some people with migraines and other conditions may be suffering through their symptoms unnecessarily. That may be changing, though. The courts have recently ruled that the First Amendment guarantees a drug maker's right to promote their products for off-label uses as long as the promotions are truthful. Let's be fair, we count on the FDA to protect us from misleading and fraudulent claims about our medicine. However, people suffering from migraines and other ailments shouldn't be kept in the dark about potential treatments either. Learn more at centerforamericatv.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And we're talking with Marion Ross, who you all know from Happy Days and other television shows and movies and also stage. And she's written her memoir entitled My Days, Happy and Otherwise. You had great times doing that show, but it wasn't always hearts and roses. I mean, you had to learn to get along with each other in some cases, like any group of people getting along or starting to work with each other. You didn't always have the warmest relationship with Tom Bosley, correct?
No, and you know, it's interesting. Tom Bosley when he was like almost 26 years old, had gone to Broadway from Chicago and won the Tony. I mean, and he played Fiorello on Broadway, and so he had made his mark. So he's a big, pretty big guy. He, I think, must have wanted somebody else to play his wife on this series. So he was not very impressed with me and was tough on me. He was tough on me. And I'm not much of a tough guy. I I'm not good at protecting myself. If I had been a little more sophisticated, I could have handled him, you know, but I couldn't handle him very well. So it was a journey for me, you know.
Well, you did work with him though for 11 years, so at some point
we did. I know.
At some point you must have softened him up.
Maybe 4 years were pretty tough going for me, because I was kind of a patsy.
Really?
Yeah. You wouldn't believe it, but...
So what do you think softened him up later on? Because you said it was the first 4 years that was difficult. At some point, he must have agreed you were his equal as an actor.
Well, I think he could see that I was more capable and everything than he thought, because I was not somebody that had a name at all. So I had to constantly prove myself to him, and it was just a tough period. In fact, I remember one time the Fonz said to me, Henry Winkler said to me, Marion, for some reason this is all your fault. And I thought, I hear you. What is it that I do to Tom that makes him want to go and get me? You know, he just wanted to get me good all the time. So somehow we all grew out of it, whatever it was, you know.
You mentioned earlier your son. I failed to mention at the time when you mentioned him that he is a very successful actor in his own right.
The Fonz?
No,
Henry Winkler?
No, your son.
Oh, my son, Jim Meskimen.
Yes, Jim.
Oh, my God, you know him.
I've seen his work. He does a lot of voice work, too, right?
That's right. He's got a commercial that's running, I think, still now, and it's for Geico, and he's George Washington being hauled across in his boat, being hauled across the freeway. And that's my son, Jim.
Yes, we've all got...
And my daughter was a writer-producer on Friends, and she is right this week creating a brand new series for ABC.
As a parent, were you eager to allow your children to go into the same business you were in?
No, not at all. Not at all. I didn't encourage that at all. Because, first of all, they could see how tough it was themselves. It's tough. So I don't want you quitting your job and going into show business, okay? It's just too tough.
So when you see your children do that, is it almost like putting up a mirror to yourself and going, oh, gosh, this was me so many years ago?
I think they had no idea how far I had to come, because I came from a small town in Minnesota, you know, southern Minnesota. Nobody in the family was in show business. But my Canadian mother, I was always raised on the idea that you can be anything. I love that.
Did your mother live long enough to appreciate the career you had in show business?
Yes, she did. Yes, she did. Thank God. Yes.
And was she always very supportive in that decision?
Oh, yes, she was all the time, because at one period when I was about 40, everything hit the wall, and I thought maybe I was going to get a divorce, and I thought maybe I would have to get a job somewhere. And my mother said, oh, no, no, because I said maybe I could renew my teaching's license. And she said, no, 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 stick with it. You can do it. So
that's nice to hear. in your book, My Days, Happy and Otherwise, what is it that you would like people to know most about you or to dispel any preconceived notion they might have of you? What would be a surprise for people when they read your book?
That's a good question. I first of all, I want them to know that I came from nothing, you know, from nothing, and you can do it. That's the lesson. You know, you want to follow your dream, you can do it. And I think the fact that I had my brother, who was only 18 months younger than me, was a crippled boy. And I often think, I even said to him one time when we were all grown up, I said, you know, if it hadn't been for you, I wouldn't be me. I wouldn't have the drive I have, because I had this crippled brother and an older sister. I'm in the middle. I didn't get any attention at all unless I was terribly, terribly special, you know. So it's like we must be grateful for the difficult years, you know, because they make you strong.
You mentioned Gary Marshall put together a softball team, which is a way of bringing the cast together in a more cohesive way, in a familial type of way. Did that familial type of way last? And by that I mean, did you stay in contact and close to those who you worked with even after Happy Days was over?
Yes, I did. I did. And each one of them has written, even Gary, because Gary has passed away and Aaron has passed away. But everybody has written a chapter in my book. Isn't that nice? Anson and Donnie Most and Henry Winkler and Ron Howard wrote the foreword. So we have remained friends and family. We've remained family.
That's good to hear. That's very, very nice
to
hear.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Are you still busy? Are you still working?
Well, no, because I'm retired. Because I think one of the last shows I did, I kept saying to my assistant, "What is that line? What do I say there? What is that? What is this?" So I said, "You know, I think, and now that I'm in my late 80s, I think it's time to quit." You know.
Do you miss it?
No. First of all, there's always something that I'm doing so that I don't totally miss it. The book has helped. Once the book is, we're through promoting the book, I probably will think, oh, now what do I do? Wow.
Well, you know,
so we'll see. I'll call you up. I'll tell you.
I keep thinking that if you do miss it, you could maybe lean on your son, because he does a lot of great voice work. You know, you can just read the script when you do voice work.
That's true. Yes, I'm thrilled with my family. Isn't that nice?
That's very nice. It's a pleasure and an honor to talk to you, Marion Ross, although I will call you Mrs. C, because I think that's how we all know you and love you.
That's fine with me, darling. That's fine with me. And you live in your beautiful city of Montreal, right?
Yes.
Lovely.
I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you, darling. Bye-bye.
Marion Ross, best known as Mrs. C from Happy Days. Her book is entitled My Days, Happy and Otherwise. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the page for this show, which is show number 0449, and you'll find links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Just a quick reminder about my book, which has many other celebrities in it. Of course, my book is Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. And like the title says, within the pages, you'll find some of my celebrity encounters, other than the one you just heard with Marion Ross, encounters with Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer, Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner, Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar, and a host of TV icons, plus two guys who left their footprints up on the moon. Order it now. It's available in hardcover, softcover, and for your e-reader on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as at my publisher at BearManorMedia.com. All the links are on our website at thestufffile.com. So buy the book. What are you waiting for? Yes. Let's get back to the stuff, shall we? When Derek and Frances Bayers became foster parents, they told the Children's Aid Society of Hamilton, Ontario, that they wouldn't lie to foster children in their care about anything. The CAS agreed with that until they barred the couple from ever being foster parents and took two children away from them because they failed to do their duty to tell the girls, age 3 and 4, that the Easter Bunny was real. Their hopes for adoption crushed, the Bayers sued. The CAS testified that it expected its staff and foster parents put their personal beliefs and values aside, but Ontario's Superior Court Justice Andrew Goodman ruled such a requirement interfered substantially with the couple's freedoms and conscience, religion, and expression. CAS Executive Director Dominic Verticchio apologized to the couple through the newspaper. I guess not apologizing in person is also something they don't teach the children at the CAS. You know, I'm trying to think back to when I was a kid at the things my parents told me. When I wouldn't eat my vegetables, their usual comeback was that children in China were starving. Well, there are over 1 billion people in China, so I guess they didn't need my vegetable eating help, did they? Yeah. The law in Rhode Island requires school districts to balance their budgets. The school committee in Tiverton adopted a $29.8 million budget, and most of a gap between funding and the budget was covered by a $340,000 increase from the state and taking $459,502 from the district's $4.4 million reserve fund. That still left them short, however. $1 short. Thus, we are requesting the town provide $1 more, as is required by state law, said school committee member Deborah Palasak. Hey, show some leadership there, Deb. Dig 5 dimes and 2 quarters out of your purse and call it a day. I mean, seriously, now you're just putting the petty in petty cash. And things went from bad to worse for 30-year-old Isaac Bonsu on March the 6th when he was charged in Alexandria, Virginia, with felony hit-and-run involving an unlikely victim. Fairfax County Police pulled Bonsu over for an equipment violation, but he apparently forgot to put it in park before exiting the vehicle. Bonsu can be seen on police dashcam video running in front of the car and then being struck by it. Unhurt, Bonsu jumped up and kept running, but police were able to catch him. Bonsu was charged with driving while intoxicated, that's his third such offense, and possessing marijuana along with the hit and run. Okay, is it really hit and run when you're the hit victim in this situation? That really sounds like piling on when it comes to the charges, don't you think? Anyway. Well, boys and girls, it's that moment of the program that you've all been waiting for as we approach the end of this show for this week. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff all presents the Idiot of the Day.
Lee County, Florida deputies are investigating an attempted robbery of a Bonita Springs 7-Eleven store. According to police, a man entered the store with his face covered with a red shirt. He demanded all the cash in the register. His weapon of choice? He pointed his finger. When the clerk refused the demand, the man ran out of the store and made his escape on a white mountain bike. I guess he's not a Star Trek fan because everybody knows that when you're in a red shirt, you have a good chance of getting killed on a mission. But seriously, why, oh why, would you walk into a store to attempt a robbery and your weapon of choice is pointing a finger at the clerk? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0449. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And once again, that's 0449. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Guests of the Stuff File program stay at their own homes. Trust me, I'm the voice for this program. I know there's no budget for accommodations. I'm reading this on a futon.